Hello and welcome to Talking Shit About, a monthly podcast where I, Elizabeth Weberman, interview someone about something they love, something they hate, something they've been through, or something they just know a lot about, and hopefully by the end we've all learned something. This month I interviewed Gaio to talk about his experience with sex addiction, something that's kind of foreign to me, but I thought it was a super interesting conversation. So Gaio, thank you so much for coming on and being vulnerable. I hope you guys get something out of this episode. Before we dive in, I just want to let you know that there's currently a merch sale going on. You can get 20% off of everything. That's right now, June 1st through June 9th. So go ahead and buy some stuff. As a reminder, the NIMBY Bingo and Abolish ICE designs, all of that money goes directly to Tillamook County Food Bank. So it's for a good cause. The rest of it goes to me to support the show. And you can find that in the show links. There's a link to my Linktree, which has a link to my store, as well as all my social media and all the places you can listen to the podcast. So thank you for listening to this intro, and let's talk some shit.
And I was like, what the fuck does that mean? I have friends that are firefighters, and I know that they use soap.
And she was screaming at me over soup.
Fuck this, I am not ever talking to a Scientologist again. These people are all insane.
I'm putting my bricks in the dumpsters, motherfuckers. Do you see me, bitches? I'm throwing my bricks. And he's just like chucking.
I am here today with Gaio, and we're going to be having kind of a personal conversation, and I'm going to let him kind of define what that looks like and as well as introduce himself. So Gaio, welcome to the pod. How are you doing?
Hi. Thanks, Elizabeth. Thanks for having me on. I'm Gaio. I'm a widowed recovering intercourse addict, sharing my journey from my troubled upbringing through a personal transformation, emphasizing on the importance of communication, emotional intelligence, and resilience, just trying to overcome life's challenges, as we all do.
Communication is a big one. I feel like that comes up in a lot of our episodes. Is there anywhere specific you would like to start?
Oh man, I guess my upbringing, just to kind of have an understanding of how I became a jerk with women and then my transformation from that. My earliest memory is nearly drowning. I was about 4 or 5, nearly drowned in a river or creek behind a house that my mom was cleaning. And when I got out of the water and came running inside, I was scared. And of course, I thought I was coming in to get consoled or consolation from my mother. And I got yelled at for coming in and going for a swim, coming in dirty, making a mess. And so it kind of shut me down. And I later realized that kind of developed my avoidant attachment style and gave me kind of a foundation of realizing or forcing myself to rely on myself to solve my own problems, that no one's going to care more about my problems than me. So the only person that's going to take care of those things is myself. And so one, that was like my full basis of resilience. And then later on, growing up in a Latin American family in the 80s with machismo, which essentially is being taught and raised that as a man, your job is to provide and protect for your family. And the bonus to that is if you do a good job and your wife isn't satisfying you, then you can go and step out on the side and get whatever you want. But with that, there's kind of rules. And with those rules, there's kind of stipulations and caveats and if-then loops. So kind of like with the Catholic Church, you're not supposed to have sex before you get married. But if you do have sex, you're not supposed to wear a condom because you're preventing a soul from coming to earth. And if you do get pregnant, you're not supposed to have an abortion because you're preventing a soul from coming to earth. And so the whole focus is preventing, keeping a soul coming on. Whereas with machismo, it's kind of that you're allowed to have a side piece, but you're not allowed to fall in love and you're not allowed to have a relationship. But if you do, you can't have kids. And if you do have kids, they're not supposed to come around. And that was like the ultimate one that sticks around, that the step family or the secondary family never comes around and knows a primary. And even up into the early 2000s, when I'd go visit family in Mexico, I would see or hear about some random male friend of a family that would pass away. We'd go to the funeral and there'd be this random woman, 2 or 3, with a couple of kids that no one knew about but suspected. And so growing up with that knowledge kind of taught me, okay, I can do whatever I want as long as I take care of my wife and provide for her. Growing up poor as well was kind of a good and a bad thing. It made me appreciate the things that I do have now. But at the same time, growing up poor left me to my own devices. I was that kid in school that everyone didn't like or hated, not because I was smart, but because I was good at remembering things, which is kind of funny because now I have a bad memory because of several concussions from motorcycle accidents and car accidents. But growing up, whenever a teacher would say something along the lines of, hey, you might want to remember this, it's going to be on the test. Well, then it's going to be on the test. So I'd pay attention, I'd remember. And I was just annoyed that she had to repeat herself five or six different times, two or three different ways to get the other dummies in class to understand. So the whole time I was interrupting. I was either trying to draw attention to myself, I was throwing paper airplanes, I was making kids laugh around me, so I'd get in trouble. When I get in trouble, my mom would beat me. And so I learned I don't like getting beat. So what's the other thing I can do to entertain myself? So what I would do is, hey, Maria, I heard your boyfriend, John, thinks that Carrie is cute. I'd go tell John, hey, John, I heard Kenneth tell his friend that he heard Carrie think you're cute, and just instigate little things like that. That was like the most basic one, and get more intricate as I got older and in high school, and having confusing loved rectangles, loved triangles, and getting people in trouble, or just seeing the fireworks fly just for my own amusement and manipulating people because that's my only source of entertainment. Growing up poor, I didn't have any toy, or I had very few toys growing up. So that is kind of the basis of how I became a jerk.
Did you have any close friends when you were growing up or around that time?
I thought I did. So I grew up on a dead end street, and I had a betrayal that I kind of just had an epiphany with a therapist in this past couple of years, where I didn't have any siblings. I'm an only child. So I'd never understood that dynamic of having trust or having someone that you can rely on. And I thought I had trust with a couple of friends that I grew up on my street because we grew up on the same street. We'd look out for each other, and by myself, or myself and two other kids were the oldest kids on the block. By the time we were 10, the high school seniors had graduated. We just saw them as big kids, and I realized now they were teenagers, but they were just high school graduates. They left the home. And so we were like that next generation of kids that were the younger ones we're looking up to, which was just 10 months to a year and a half younger than us. And so we were all roughly the same age, but three of us were the oldest. We were all born in the 70s, or me and the other two were in the 70s. The other rest were younger. And anyways, so I was always that big kid that was always head and shoulders taller than most of the other kids. I was bigger, broader, and all the other kids of my same age group were, or same grade level, were smaller and more frail. So I'd often get mistaken for being a grade or two level higher. And when I was in second or third grade, my friend Kyle, he was on the same street as me. And one day we're all playing outside in recess, and a group of other kids, they weren't really bullies. They were just kind of boys being boys. We were just roughhousing. And one day, you know, we would always pick on one kid or another. Like, it would just kind of rotate around. Everybody get picked on, and eventually it kind of came to my turn, which, you know, eventually it happened. But this one time, you know, these boys were shoving me, pushing me around, and I was usually able to stand my ground because of my size. But eventually, the second or third time it came into my time, I got shoved and knocked over, and I fell. I was like, how the hell did I fall? They're not that strong enough. And when I was on the ground, I realized Kyle had kind of gotten on all fours, so that way I would trip over him. And so when I got tripped over, I realized I can't trust this guy. You know, here I thought, we grew up on the street. He's my friend. He's my buddy. Thick and thin, thick as thieves, and he betrayed me. And so that betrayal kind of re-cemented or re-reminded me of, hey, I can only trust myself. I can only rely on myself. And so then I lost a bit of humanity in being caring or finding others worthy of finding others worthy of my trust.
Were you surrounded by many girls like when you were younger, or was it?
Just typical co-ed, elementary school. And it wasn't that I was surrounded by girls, but I knew I wanted to do something with girls. I was attracted to girls. By second grade, I wanted to have a girlfriend. Didn't know what I wanted to do with them other than kiss them. I know I wanted to do more, but I didn't know what that was. And so my mother, she kind of realized that I was into girls. And I forgot how the whole conversation started about the birds and the bees, but it was just over my head because she's using scientific terms, you know, vagina, vulva, uterus, ovaries, testes, and all the other stuff. And I'm just confused and just kind of nodding along. Okay, whatever. And so eventually she realizes just all over my head. And so in her frustration, she kind of just says, you're trying to put your dick in her pussy. I'm like, oh, that's what I want to do. Okay. Thanks, mom. Like I didn't say that, but the light bulb went off in my head and she saw that. She said, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm responsible for you, not your kid. Cause that's how you get pregnant. If you get a girl pregnant, you're going to go live with her and raise that kid. Cause I'm only responsible for you. And my mother was a loan shark, which is surprising because I think she was just good enough to help us survive, not so much in having us live in a life of luxury. But I do recall her stabbing a man in the arm for interrupting her while she was trying to get him to pay her back. There was other circumstances around it, but around that. But what stood out to me is that she stabbed someone for interrupting her. So I knew she doesn't fuck around. So she said, I'm going to go live with someone else. If I get a girl pregnant, then I better not get a girl pregnant because I'm going to live somewhere else. So I always had that fear. I wanted to do something with a girl, but I was also scared of getting a girl pregnant. And of course, you know, in high school, middle school, the rumors are always, oh yeah, you know, so-and-so got pregnant after having sex one time. And now as I got older or talking to those friends years later in high school or after graduating is that they were having sex for weeks and months on end. They stopped using a condom and eventually got pregnant. But the rumor mill was, oh yeah, they were using a condom and got pregnant the first time. It's like, oh, shit. If they're going to get pregnant with a condom, then what chance do I have? So I was always trying to find a girl that would want to have sex, but at the same time, scared to have sex. So I was doing other things, oral, with girls or vice versa. And so finally, I just got up the nerve after my mom passed away to have sex with a girl. We were each other's first. And she broke my heart. After we graduated, I proposed to her. And I found out a month later after I proposed that she'd been cheating on me since a month before I proposed. But there's kind of an ironic twist to that because I found out back 15 years after the fact that she wasn't cheating. She only said that because she knew that I had a disdain for drug addicts and she was hooked on cocaine. And so my suspicion of her behavior was because she was on coke. And she didn't want me or her parents to find out that she was on drugs. So she admitted to cheating on me to keep me from breaking up with her for whatever her logic was. And in that moment, I decided, okay, I'm going to cheat on you with 100 girls and throw it in your face. And so then that's where my deviation into intercourse addiction kind of started.
And just so I don't forget to say this, I really appreciate you being so vulnerable, especially with the early childhood stuff like that.
Thank you.
That sticks with you.
Yeah, it is. And it's funny because I've spoken about this before, but having a therapist kind of work through emotions and whatnot over the years, in the past few months, revisiting those issues kind of bring up more feelings where in the past I could talk about, no big deal. But now this past year has been kind of eye-opening and emotion-evoking. Emotional. There we go. That's the word.
This relationship. So you were fresh out of high school, right? Is that kind of around the time frame that we're at?
Yes. So fresh out of high school, when I decided to start cheating on my fiance. And that was also the time I got on AOL, or I was on AOL back then. So this is mid-90s. So for listeners and for anyone that's not aware, we didn't have easy access to the internet like we do now. So to get on the internet, you had to have a computer that's $2,000. In today's dollars, that's roughly about $7,000 just for a computer. And then you had to pay $10 a month, plus you had to have a secondary phone line. So we're talking an extra, today, about $50-$60 just to be able to get online. And you had to be at a computer. There wasn't any cell phone, or there were cell phones, but you could only call. Later on, you could start texting on phones. But anyways, so the best way to equate it is back then, imagine the people you know now that have a Tesla, not an electric vehicle, but specifically a Tesla. They have to have certain amount of wealth. They only have a certain type of socioeconomic standard or socioeconomic status, right? So only those people had access to the internet, or university students, or the military. But for the most part, anyone else that wanted to get online, imagine just your average Tesla owner. So most people that were on the internet were kind of trusting of others and were excited to meet other people that had the internet. And so whenever you'd say, oh, hey, I'm in this part of town, let's meet up for coffee, let's get to know each other, blah, blah, blah. And then it would be exciting to be able to tell people, hey, I have this internet friend. The funny thing is that the inverse of that is dating sites kind of started back then, but there was a stigma of using dating sites because what kind of a schmuck are you that you can't talk to a person in person, that you got to find someone online? And so most people in the mid to late 90s, if they met online and had a relationship, they would make up a story of how they met and never mention that they met on the internet because there was that stigma. And I know a few people that did get married and still to this day lie about how they met because that stigma is just so prevalent in Gen X and some elder millennials that they will not talk about a relationship that they started online. Now, if they meet someone on a dating app on Tinder, yeah, they'll talk about it. But if they met back in the early 90s, no, because, you know, clearly you had no game or, you know, you were a failure as a human. That was kind of like the way it was seen. So anyways, it was just so easy to meet people online. Once I realized how easy it was to get girls to meet me in person, then it kind of became a game of how quickly can I get a girl to sleep with me? And eventually it was not even a challenge. So then I've came up with how can I make it a game of what can I get them to do before they end their chance of sleeping with me? And that became boring as well. So then I started making a point system of, if I can get a girl to sleep with me in less than 24 hours, that's a point. If it took longer than 24 hours, it would be half a point. And so then I was counting that way. So instead of counting 100 women, I counted 100 points. And then I realized later, like, oh, I was a little off because half points come down the road. So anyways, finally threw it in my fiance's face. We broke up. She wanted to stay together. I left for the army. And kind of we just lost touch over that time. So.
And what would you say your like view of women was like at that time? Like, did you have any like women friendships or anything?
No, not at all. Or the women friendships I had were more for access to their friends. It was always, if I had a female friend, it wasn't because I valued her friendship. I would let her believe that. But I would use the friendship specifically to hook up with her friends. And, my view of women wasn't, I mean, it was bad, but not terrible. I just treat them as disposable. If a woman stopped wanting to see me, no big deal, because I had a rotation of women that I would see. I think I had 3 to 5 every week, plus new women that I met. So it wasn't, I had an abundance of women. So it wasn't really it wasn't healthy at all in any way, shape, or form. But it was healthy for my ego in the sense of coming out of my shell, coming out of poverty and not defining myself as being a poor kid or being a poor Mexican kid, but being a Don Juan, being successful with the ladies and being able to pass off my exes or girls that I used to hook up with to my friends. Oh yeah, no, you know, you'll probably like my friend Sean, cause you know, he works out a lot and he can, you know, he'll like you. Or, you know, hey, my friend Andres, he's really into Blasians or whatever. So I'd always kind of shove them away from me because I got tired of them or bored of them because either the sex wasn't interesting or they weren't interesting. So I just move on. And it took me until about 2010 that I realized that I had a problem. In a odd female relationship or female friendship that I had, was having sex with her early on and then later on decided, you know what? I kind of want to keep her as a friend. Like she has the same twisted sense of humor as me. She and I like messing with people and, you know, we would laugh at very dark jokes. So I figured this is rare. I can't find this very easily, but I don't want a relationship with her because I know I can't trust her to be monogamous to me. So let's just be friends. And so we remained friends through about a year. And she invited me to Celebrate Recovery, which is a Christian umbrella for all the anonymouses type, alcoholics, sexaholics, narcotics, all of those. and also for food addiction, people pleasing, codependency, and a couple others. And so the reason she asked me to come along was because she was such a people pleaser that she had a hard time saying no when the staff would ask her to stay behind and help clean up, which she would usually do. She'd always help, but she'd always end up being the last person standing. She'd be there till 10, 11 o'clock at night cleaning up because most of the other staff would be like, oh yeah, she's taking care of it, and they'd leave early and let her finish. And so she got frustrated because she was always the last person there, but she didn't have enough backbone to stand up for herself. So I would show up right at, or I'd go to the meetings with her. And right when everything was over, hey, we got to go. We're going to go catch the 9:15, whatever movie was coming out back then. I can't think of anything at the time, but probably Harry Potter, something. It was like 2010. So whatever was coming out at that time.
Probably an
And
Avengers movie or something.
maybe, yeah, Avengers early on, MCU, but whatever it was always just, hey, we got to go. We can't stay because we're going to go catch a movie. And so we would on the way kind of laugh, oh, hey, those dummies, they think we're really going to go see a movie, and we'd go out to eat or we'd go do something else. And this one particular meeting, there was a guy that was talking about his testimony about his drug addiction. And when he got to the point of why he started using drugs, for something, just something clicked in me about his reasons were the same as mine for using sex, because I had a bad day, because I was sad, because I was lonely, because I was bored. Because my feelings were hurt, because I didn't get a promotion, because of whatever. Any little reason that he had to use drugs was the same reason that just kind of clicked. Oh, crap. I'm a sex addict. And up until that point, I thought sex addiction was just some made up thing that public relations for celebrities, so they don't have to end up paying alimony. Because at the time, I think the two biggest ones that stuck out was David Duchovny and Tiger Woods. Mr. X Files and Golf Pro. And I just thought, that's bullshit. That's not real. And when I realized, oh no, this is a real thing, I kind of had this inner dialogue, crap, I do have a problem, and it is a real problem. So how do I fix it? Because the whole time I was going to celebrate recovery, I was lying to these guys and saying, oh, I'm a porn addict and I masturbated today because I saw porn. And to me at the time, just masturbation seemed gross. Like, why would I bother doing that when I can go find a girl? Like, it's easy for me to find a girl. I don't get why you guys can't. You guys are lame. That was kind of my mentality about it, but I just kind of stayed quiet. And so at the time, I had health insurance, started seeing a therapist. Early on, me and therapists didn't work out well because I had a disdain in the way they approached things. Either they were too analytical. So I was an electrician at the time. And the best way to equate it is they were kind of like an electrical engineer, and I'm a electrician. So I know how to install things. I can read blueprints and install electrical components in a building or in a house. Electrical engineers know how to design it, but have no idea how to do it. And so that's the way I kind of saw the therapy. Like, they understood my problem, but they didn't know what I was going through or didn't know the experience. So then I started going to Sex Addicts Anonymous. And in there, at least in the two or three different groups that I went to, it felt like they were just white knuckling it. They weren't addressing their issues. They were just, yeah, I was thinking about going and having sex today, but I didn't want to disappoint my sponsor and this and that and the other. And I didn't want to have to, disappoint you guys. And I trust you guys, and I know you guys aren't going to judge me, but I didn't want to do it and be a failure. And their whole thing was just living up to an expectation, not dealing with their issues. And so finally, I circled back to Celebrate Recovery. And admitted, hey, this is really my problem. I was lying. This is also the reason I was coming before, because my friend can't say no. So I came here to do that, and then realize I'm an intercourse addict and I need help. So I started with small group studies with Celebrate Recovery. And then from there, once I was done with the course, then I was more open to working with a therapist. And since then, touch base every few years for couple of months to a year, and then kind of, okay, I'm good now. I'll go on my own for a little while.
And were you still, at what point, were you not with your fiance anymore?
Oh
Or
no, yeah, we were done. When I went to the army, before I got out of basic, or probably like a month or a couple of weeks into basic, she'd sent me a letter and just blew me off. After that, I got out of the army, hooked up with a girl that I'd met on AOL way back. So we kind of stayed touch, kept in touch, and we got married. And I told her early on, hey, I'm going to have sex every day. If you want to be a part of that, that's up to you. And when we were dating, that was fine. And apparently she either forgot about it or thought I was joking. And so once we were married, we'd go 2 or 3 days without having sex. I'd go find someone else. We'd have sex for a couple more days. And then she'd find out about the other girl and she'd get mad and not want to have sex. So I'd go, okay, fine. I'll go have sex with someone else. And it's an endless loop of me hooking up with other women, her finding out about it later, getting mad, not wanting to have sex. She got tired of not having sex. So then we would. And then whatever. So it's just an endless vicious cycle for 8 years. Finally, she got tired of me and we got divorced.
So I'm super glad that you were able to find a recovery group and start that path. That's pretty awesome that you just kind of like stumbled into it. So with therapies, have you found any like specific kind of therapy particularly helpful?
For me, the most helpful was Stellar Recovery. I forget the name. They always tell me the types because there's three different that we've gone through. Remember the names? I'm blanking, but it's like the modalities, and they explain it to me why and how to address my issues. And so one of them is Socratic-ish. They ask you, well, why do you think you did this? Why do you think you did that? What brings you around? And then the other one is kind of giving me work to kind of go back, kind of like shadow work. And I forget the other one.
Aside from like therapies, like what other things have been really helpful in like your journey to recovery?
Just understanding that my value as a man is not based on how many women I've been with, and that increasing or bettering my mental health has improved my life outside of it. It's also helped my relationships. So after going through therapy, I finally found a healthy relationship. We were together for 4 years and 11 days before she passed away. We were married for just under 2 years. Even though it was a short relationship, it was very fulfilling. And in that, we always had constant communication. And for your listeners, I know communication has been a buzzword for the past couple of years, especially since COVID. But by communication, it's specifically making sure you understand each other, not just trying to get your point across. Because most people think communication is just speaking and making sure you're heard. But I think the point is making sure you are understood and you understand the person that's speaking to you, the person you're communicating with. And so one of the most important things was we never went to bed angry. There'd be a couple of times where she'd tell me, hey, you said or did this and it hurt my feelings, or I didn't like that. I just wanted you to know how I feel about it. And so I would ruminate on it for a day or two and kind of realize, oh, you know what? You are right. That was kind of fucked up of me to do. Or I'd be like, you know what? I don't think that's such a big issue. So we need to have a conversation about this. Why is it such an issue for you? Because I don't understand it. Help me understand why it's an issue. Another time she would kind of realize that it would be something from her past that bothered her. It wasn't so much what I did, but just kind of a reminder. And so we only had probably two or three of those conversations per year. And for the most part, otherwise, it was just a great relationship. We were that hashtag relationship goals that everybody wanted to be or was envious of. We would do things basically 7 days a week. If it wasn't roller derby practice or roller derby games that we were attending or part of, it would be like a museum gala opening, a friend's divorce party, a friend's house, a friend's housewarming, a birthday party, whatever. So it was always out and about doing stuff, not just going out to bars or clubbing. And so we were always busy. Finally, like in the last 6 months that we were together, we started taking a break or taking it easy, where one Saturday a month, we would have a D&D game at home, and then we'd have a potluck and then karaoke at our place at night, which I would either DJ or KJ, just depending whether how many people showed up.
That's adorable. I love that. That's so cool.
Thank you.
I hate to like bring it down because that's such like a positive note. But I'll try to reword this question that I had. But what things do you kind of like, is there anything that you kind of try to like avoid, like any particular kind of people or media or anything just for like your well-being?
No, I think for me specifically, growing up Gen X, I kind of have a resilience and a thick skin. So I don't have triggers in the sense, or I do have triggers, but I don't let them affect me. Kind of like little bullets for Superman, in the sense that I see it, I recognize it, and I acknowledge it. I don't just try to ignore it because then it'll kind of creep up. It'll be like, oh, hey, so what if there's a video of a girl twerking? And it's attractive, but it's not really my thing. For me, sexuality or attractiveness of a woman is more based on what's hidden, what you can. So for me, growing up, always found business casual women more attractive because there's always something, you know, it's like opening up a present. And versus, you know, a woman in lingerie or a woman in a strip club, you know, really doesn't do anything for me. Yeah, it's an attractive body or an attractive woman, but, you know, it's there and everybody can see it. So it's not a special something for me. So that's usually what I usually go for. But as far as dealing with life, if it's something I don't want to do then, or don't want to have to experience, and I just don't do it, like strip clubs, I'll go if a friend's like, hey, it's my birthday and we're going to do this and we're going to start there. We're going to end up there after going out to eat or whatever. I'll go ahead and join in. But it's not like I go out of my way. Oh, you know what? It's Friday. I got an extra $500 in my pocket. Let's go to a strip club. That's not really my cup of tea. And going out to clubs is kind of annoying nowadays. So going out to finding or seeing women that are more likely to say yes, it's just not a goal for me, because what I want more is a happy, healthy relationship, not the fun night.
And what are the things that you look for in a relationship now?
Oh, man, it's tough because, so with my wife, we were poly-ish. We did ethical non-monogamy. And so we'd have threesomes, and we're kind of a throuple. We had a girlfriend for a little while, off and on, or we'd have different girlfriends, and then they'd either get too attached to her, too attached to me. And so we had to like cut it off. So now what works for me, because of my past and because of my sexual interests, I can't find just one woman. So if I want a list of 10 things that I want to do with a woman, most women would only be open to two or three. And so usually I have a primary girlfriend, and then I'll have former partners that I used to see and see them for sex exclusively. So every now and again, I'll have a secondary or third girlfriend. But in those relationships, what I look for is things that I'm missing overall. So with my primary, we have just a very dark, twisted sense of humor. We can joke around about death. We can joke around about, you know, the misfortune of others. You know, anything super dark is just amusing to us. And that's partly just because of our nature, but also being Gen X and also being widows. So we have a shorthand in understanding each other of, you know, how precious life is really. And so with other relationships, it'll be something that I'm missing, but it's more platonic in a sense. So what I look for is either someone that's also into crafts. So right now I'm into sewing. See, not this shirt. This is my pattern shirt, but I have another one that I made, and I've been trying to get into pants, but those are a pain in the ass. So usually it's more of who I can learn from and have a relationship that we can kind of grow together or push each other to develop some type of skill or craft that we're doing, or someone else that enjoys riding motorcycles. So being able to go and ride on a motorcycle, if I have someone behind me, my partner, she usually gets scared if I dig too deep into turns. And one of my favorite things is called scraping the pegs, where you lean so far down where the pegs of the motorcycle scrape on the ground. And so she gets terrified of that. So I like having someone I can ride with where we can go through near our area through very twisty turns and go through them fast. So we do scrape our pegs. So it's always trying to find someone that can challenge me or do fun things that I can't do with one particular person. That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad that you figured out, you know, what works for you. And
yeah. And the important thing is being honest, especially with your partner. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that a lot of guys and girls don't have an honest communication about sex, about what they want in the bedroom. They just kind of stumble together and figure it out. And it's frustrating because I'll hear two sides of the same story from a couple friend. You know, the guy will talk to me while we're hanging out, having drinks, and he'll say, man, you know, she doesn't do this for me, or I wish she would try to do that, but I've always tried to bring it up and she always says no. And I hear from her is, you know, either he can't make me climax, or you know, he's always too aggressive, or he always do this, or he doesn't spend enough time with foreplay. And I asked them both, hey, have you ever had this conversation with them? Yeah, I have. Like, have you? And it turns out that they just make their demand, but they don't try to negotiate or have a conversation about what they want. And so one thing I always try to push with my friends and anyone who listens is have an honest conversation that's not an argument, that's not confrontational. You never do this for me. Just, hey, look, babe, I really want to try this in the bedroom, or I really want to try bedroom stuff outside of the bedroom. I want to go try this in a car and in a parking lot somewhere. I want to go to a cemetery. I want to go to a church, whatever. But having a conversation about things you want to try and do and say, hey, I don't want to do those things you want to try, but I'm willing to try these other things and negotiate and have a conversation, especially women. You know, there's a big orgasm gap between women that they don't orgasm as much as males do, and letting them know, hey, I need foreplay, or I need to bring a toy along, or I need this particular type of stimulation is important. But sex is so taboo, at least for Americans, that it's sad how few relationships are successful because of that one component. And it's not the most important thing. It's kind of funny because sex is probably a fraction of a percent, if even 1% of what a relationship, what makes a relationship. But most people put such a focus on it because they're not getting as much as they want, or as fulfilling sex as they want.
Well put. Do you have any advice for your younger self? I guess at any point, kind of early on in your journey before you encountered Celebrate Recovery?
I would say my value isn't based on how many women I've been with. And, you know, women aren't disposable. Women are valuable. They do have value. I don't believe we're equals as far as relationships. I do think we are compatible. We're like yin and yang. So we're not equal in the sense of it's equally divided, you know, how yin and yang is, but we're not equal like 50-50. You know, it's not going to be 50-50 for everything. It's going to be 60-40 in yard work, or 70-30 in housework. It's going to be whatever with bills. It's going to be, you know, there's going to be asymmetrical various things. And it might even out to 50-50, but for the most part, it's going to skew one way or another. It's going to be maybe 55-45. It might be 60-40 at the end of the day. But as long as there's honest communication, as long as, you know, there's defined roles and expectations, like you make clear, hey, this is what I like, this is what I want, it'll make things better for yourself, not just me, but for anyone else. So, you know, instead of trying to fit the mold, because that was kind of my problem growing up, is that I grew up with machismo, which is, hey, men run the household, period. Or men rule the house, women run the household. But then at the same time, growing up in the 80s, you know, it's all this 50-50, feminism, shared workload, 50-50, all this other stuff. And so I was trying to make both of those two things fit and trying to fit into a mold versus having a conversation with what works for you with your partner is going to work better.
We kind of went through your story pretty quickly. Was there anything else that you wanted to touch on, or anything else that came onto mind while you were talking?
I think this is like the most succinct way of putting my life story, I guess. Normally I kind of go more in the weeds about different things, but this works out pretty well.
Gaio, thank you so much for coming on and again, being so vulnerable. I think it's beautiful how your perspective and life has changed. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Yeah, I wish you the best and thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks again, Gaio, for coming on the show, and I hope y'all got something out of that interview. We'll be back again in July with another interview. We're a reminder, not doing the microsodes because I started grad school and a new full-time job, so I don't have time for that. And if you want to support the show, there are a few ways you can do that. You can join Patreon for $2 a month, where you'll get exclusive and behind-the-scenes content, as well as early access to interviews. You can buy my merch, and again, there's a sale 20% off of everything right now, June 1st through June 9th, and you can follow me on all of your podcasting platforms, hit subscribe, and what else? I'm sure there's other things. You can follow me on social media. I haven't been super active, again, because I've been busy with school and work, but it's there. You know, I post when I can. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you again next month.